It is one bell of the afternoon watch. This is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair on Voice of Vashon 101.9 on the FM band, broadcasting with an enormous amount of power all over the magical Isle of Vashon. And for those of us who are outside the range of that tremendous amount of power, you can get us on voiceofvashon.org, where we stream live every week at 12:30 hours Pacific Daylight Time, one bell of the afternoon watch. The greetings, of course, go out to Captain Joe's people all over the world, from Singapore on one side of the world to the Kingdom of Sweden and Stockholm on the other side, and all of the ships and aircraft underway in between, and all of Captain Joe's people in all of those places in between those two cities. The binnacle list, as always, has signs of improvement in some places, steady as she goes in other places, and not doing so well in others, and be aware, as always, that your captain is always concerned and thinking about each person of whom I'm aware that's on the binnacle list. And also, this particular week, the whole Pacific Northwest I'm putting on the binnacle list, because we've had no rain now for about, I'd say, about 2 months. However, I looked up into the sky, as I do every day, not seeking a sign, but looking at the cloud formations, and to my delight, I saw some cirrus clouds. That word is spelled C-I-R-R-U-S, and those are the very high, wispy clouds that you see way, way up in the high, in the way up in the sky. And cirrus clouds are usually, not always, but usually, the precursor of a rain or a low coming, which usually brings with it some rain. Now, I have been watching the predictions, the weather predictions, which the ones that I have some validity go out to about 10 days. And I thought to myself, well, if there are cirrus clouds up there, then that rain must be out there someplace. And sure enough, I looked on the prediction, and there is predicted to be tonight at about 03 o'clock, which is 3 o'clock is six bells of the midwatch, the time of greatest darkness and the time of greatest danger. And so at six bells of the midwatch, it is predicted to be a 60% chance of rain. I will report next week whether or not my prediction is came to pass, that coming from seeing the cirrus clouds up there, and whether or not the weather.com got it wrong and we got no rain. The calendar is chock-a-block, as we say in bosun's mate's terms, chocks and blocks. Chock-a-block, with events coming up in this week. The first one that I have on my calendar is Thursday, the 9th of September. The Washington State Fair is already underway, but that is the beginning of the rodeo or rodeo, depending on one's proclivities and pronunciation. And the each performance of the, I like the word rodeo, because that's the way that it was pronounced by the composer that wrote rodeo. And it is followed by a dancing in the dirt party. Now, the picture that this one conjures up is that after the rodeo, one would hope that they do at least some sort of policing up of the dirt before everybody goes out into the for the dancing in the dirt party. I just give that warning here that you may want to just cast your eyes downward. If you go, first of all, to Rodeo, that's the way Copeland pronounced it in his musical composition, Rodeo. And cast your eyes down for any shoals poking up in the dirt. So I have asked Truman, who grew up as a son of a ranch and was around horses and cattle for all the time before he went into the service. And I asked him whether he was competing, and he was very explicit that not only was he not competing, but that he was not even going, not even for dancing in the dirt. The next one after that is for the 10th of September, which has been proclaimed as a National Day of Service. And because I am a veteran and because I'm on the Department of Veterans Affairs email list, I get a lot of notifications. And this particular one is that on the 10th of September, which is Friday, the national cemeteries are all hosting a gathering where people can clean the headstones in the national cemeteries. Our national cemetery here in the Pacific Northwest is the Tahoma National Cemetery, and there are a number of my classmates and their wives whose their address is now the Tacoma National Cemetery. My classmate and brother, icebreaker Captain Joe Smith, and his lady Shirley in particular are out there. And so if you are looking for a service to perform, you could go to your national cemetery. And for Tahoma, the event starts at 10 o'clock out at the Tahoma National Cemetery. Speaking of headstones, I've got one more event, which of course is the recognition of the 20th anniversary of 11 September, when the World Trade Center buildings were taken down and the terrible crash in the field in Pennsylvania and the Pentagon. And there'll be a lot of memorials, a lot of memories. My particular one is that Mary R. and I had moved onto the island just not very too long before that. And we were watching on television as the aircraft actually flew right into the sides of those buildings. It was a terrible, terrible thing to watch. Been impressed into my mind for the rest of my life. And so there will be a number of opportunities, different places, different times to remember that, to remember the people that we lost, and to remember all of the people who worked so hard to save people who were fleeing from those buildings falling down. In my own service, the Coast Guard was very much involved in the waterside evacuation from Battery Park, just to the south of where the World Trade Center was, until the 11th of September. So back to the Tahoma National Cemetery and the gravestones. I live on a private road, and those of us who live on the road own the pieces of it. And one of our members is the retired rector of Trinity Episcopal Church, which is on First Hill, the side of First Hill, over in the city of Seattle. And his father was here not too long ago, and through a rather convoluted story, they found the gravestone for Jeff's great-great-grandfather. And they found it in the Mount Pleasant Cemetery here in over in Seattle. The interesting thing to me about this, Jeff took a photograph of this, and the interesting thing to me about it is that his great-great-grandfather was a Civil War veteran, and his grave is marked by a gravestone which is exactly like the ones that you will see in Arlington, the ones that you will see in Tahoma that mark the gravesite for my classmates that are out there and their wives, and exactly like the one that will mark my gravesite when the time comes. Oh, let it be a long way away, because I have still a lot of things to do, many turns of the propeller yet to have happened. But it was interesting because Jeff's great-great-grandfather was, it's one of the first of the grave sites in Seattle when Seattle was just being settled. So, and interesting to me that as a veteran, he had exactly the same gravestone that will mark my grave when that time comes. I've done a little bit of geographical investigation, and I have known about the islands of St. Pierre and Miquelon for a long, long time. I've been by them, sailed by them, but I've never stopped there. They are a little piece of France, which is just to the south of Newfoundland. And, of course, you can only get to it by ferry or by air. And I am intrigued by this place. I am, first of all, a Francophile. I am a Parisian by choice, if not by nationality. And one of the things that I have to get done before it's time for my gravestone to be put into place next to Mary R., is to go to two places. The first one is Tonga. I really want to go to Tonga. And to St. Pierre and Miquelon. And it will be much easier, I think, to get to St. Pierre than it will be to get to Tonga. It certainly will not take as long. So I did a little bit of research into this. Americans right now, because of the virus, are not welcome. But if we can get ourselves sorted out in this country so that I can travel to the Kingdom of Sweden, I really want to get to Stockholm and see my Stockholm family. I'm hopeful to be able to go to Singapore in the spring and see my Singapore family while they're still there under contract. And so we need in this country to get our pariah state designation lifted so that we can travel once again without restrictions. So take a look at and call up St. Pierre and Miquelon. It just looks to me like a wonderful, fascinating place. And I am going to go there. And when I go there, I will do my broadcast from St. Pierre and Miquelon. The Coast Guard cutter Monroe, you will remember that is spelled M-U-N-R-O, named for Signalman Second Class Douglas Monroe, Medal of Honor. And she has been assigned to the 7th Fleet. And she's been working with the Philippine Coast Guard, with the Japanese Coast Guard, the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force, which is what they call their Navy. And she has been, in fact, has refueled from a Japanese oiler. Now, I find this to be a particularly interesting thing to have happened because in Vietnam, we would stay on the gun line for 2-3 months at a time without touching at any port. And we were able to do this because every few days an oiler or an ammunition ship or a store ship would come out on the gun line, and we would get up alongside and replenish underway with both ships moving along. It's only in recent years that the Japanese have had this capability. And I've just seen a photograph of Monroe alongside this Japanese oiler with the hoses over connecting the two ships. It's interesting to me that this system, which was developed and then perfected during World War II, is now has spread to our allies, and the Japanese oiler looks to be, to me, to be a very smart, seaman-like looking ship, and the way that the ships were working together, they looked to me to be at just about the right distance apart. I critique all of those things, and I report them here to all of you who have spent a lot of time on the gun line in Vietnam and have been kept alive by the underway replenishment system. One of the things that one of the places that these ships go for their own replenishment is Yokosuka, which is to the south of Tokyo in Tokyo Bay. And in my first ship out of the academy, I made a number of trips into Yokosuka because the ship that I was assigned to went into Japan for about a 10-day R&R period before going back out on station out in the middle of the Pacific, 34 north, 164 east. And somewhere in one of those trips to Yokosuka, the ship, the Coast Guard cutter Winnebago, she was named for the Winnebago Indian tribe. All of the ships in that class were named for Indian tribes. And in one of those trips, the ship acquired a dog. And she was the first and last dog that I have ever had in any ships in which I was directly connected. She was, in fact, a miserable dog, and she had been acquired from one of the Yokosuka businesses just outside the gate. And she, for some reason, had acquired a dislike for anyone that did not wear, in those days, the khaki uniform, which was worn by officers and chief petty officers. And she had bitten just about everybody else in the crew. And so, but her other, she had other unredeeming characteristics, and one of them was that when she lived in the wardroom, which was all the way aft in that particular class of ship, and when we would get into a storm, which was in particular in the wintertime, the typhoons and storms of lesser intensity would still knock the ship around a lot, and she would slide back and forth on the deck. And as she would slide back and forth, she would exhibit high levels of flatulence, which made it very difficult to go into the wardroom for meals. So her name was Baby San. It probably conditioned my thinking to have a dog aboard any ship that I was the captain of. And so I have never had a dog, and those few times when we did have pets, they did not stay very long under my command. So the Monroe is working with not only with the various coast guards of the in the Pacific. Interesting fact for today is that the Japanese Coast Guard was founded during occupation times and was modeled very, very closely to the U.S. Coast Guard. We had people then, as we do today, people who were advisors to the Japanese Coast Guard. And so we have a very close working relationship with them, and in particular in such areas as the search and rescue business. I've done a little bit of follow-up on the article that I discussed in the magazine Professional Mariner. So that's our magazine for today, Professional Mariner. And you all will recall that there was a letter in the most recent issue which talked about restoring Coast Guard search and rescue proficiency, which led me to do a little bit of digging because the author of that letter made no mention of the search and rescue school. And so I thought, well, maybe that school has been decommissioned and it no longer exists. I'm a graduate of the first class of the National Search and Rescue School, and I discovered that it is not only still in existence, but it is very much an active part of the training of Coast Guard specialists in search and rescue, the Air Force specialists who are in search and rescue, and the U.S. Navy. The school is staffed by both Coast Guard and Air Force people, and it is over 50 years old. The class that I went into was in 1966. It was then in Governor's Island, New York. And I went to that class to validate the syllabus because although I was relatively junior and could not be considered to be an expert in anything at that point, it was felt that it would be a good thing for me to take it, A, because I was available and my office was right there in Governor's Island and therefore was no travel costs involved. And secondly, that if I could master the syllabus, then probably just about anybody could. And so I went to that first class. However, the school is not only still in existence. It's in now at the Coast Guard Training Center in Yorktown, Virginia, a place where I was the captain of two different Coast Guard cutters, and is one of my favorite places in not only the Coast Guard world, but that part of the Commonwealth of Virginia is one of my favorite places in the whole world. The school still exists, and I have had a look at the syllabus, and I think that they have done a really great job, and I'm a little bit mystified as to why this article doesn't mention that. So I think I'm going to write a letter to the magazine and to the author and ask him why what was going on there and why he did not mention that. Another one of the magazines, I don't have a book for today. I'm my friend and colleague, Dr. Sam Green, is sending me a copy of two of his books of poems, and I'm going to read a couple more of those, and that will be our book when that book shows up. I sent it to him to have it inscribed. I treasure books that are written by friends, and I always ask them to inscribe them. And when that when that parcel arrives from Dr. Green, I will read from it, and that will be our book then. But so today, instead of another book, we're going to have another magazine, and it's the Seaways from the Nautical Institute, which is headquartered in London, and is an organization for, in particular, captains and people who manage captains. And one of their magazines, they have several publications, and one of them is called Seaways, and one of them has an article about seaman's eye. And seaman's eye is defined as that ability which comes from experience about knowing where your ship is, how much space she's taking up, how much of her is going to swing when you get her to swinging, when you are in really tight quarters. Those are all go into making up what is called seaman's eye. And the article talks about replacing some of seaman's eye with, in particular, global positioning system. And I am here to say that along with open bridge wings, I am one of those that has a pretty good seaman's eye. And there is no electronic system that is going to replace that of either my ability, should I ever be able to go back to sea again, or people that I have trained to be able to manage their ship in close quarters without looking into some scope or looking at some digital readout. Seaman's eye it is, ladies and gentlemen. The a little warning, the Gulf Stream is at risk. The Gulf Stream, of course, flows alongside our coastline from south to north, and there is a definite wall that where the temperature changes from the cooler water to the warmer water of the stream, and so there is some scientific evidence that is beginning to be developed, which says that the Gulf Stream is being destroyed because the water, the cooler water, is warming up and thus breaking down the differential between the cooler water and the warmer water where that wall is. I will, of course, continue to report on this as I get other other information. From G Captain today, there was an article. We've talked a lot. Well, we as parents have talked a lot about bullying. And G Captain has had an article in the issue that came to my email today, which talks about bullying in ships. And that one of the reasons why this is happening more now than maybe in the past, I submit that it also has something to do with captains behaving less like captains and more like managers, but that's a personal opinion and about which I will pontificate more in the future. You may be certain of that, the crews are small and they are not necessarily, and in fact are almost always, of mixed nationalities. And that this means that there is not the same homogeneity of culture that there was in ships when they had crews that all came from the same country. It's an interesting theory, and I bring it up because when we talk about bullying in all sorts of other environments and in all sorts of other contexts, here it is also in an environment and context with which I'm very familiar, but not in any of my own ships. These are in merchant ships. I've received an invitation in that same G Captain, not the same message, a different one, an invitation message inviting me to the Liquefied Natural Gas Bunkering Summit. Now, the word bunkering means fueling. And so many, many ships now are being converted or are being built originally to be fueled with liquefied natural gas, LNG. And so no doubt there's a need for a summit of people to talk about this. However, it's in November, and in November I hope to be traveling someplace other than to Jacksonville for the LNG Bunkering Summit. If any of Captain Joe's people would like to go to this, please let me know at CaptainJoe@CenturyTel.net, and I will make sure that you get the invitation to the LNG Bunkering Summit. And with that, I've come once again to the end of my time. And with that, as always, it is my wish and my desire and my command that if you have people for whom you are responsible, that you watch their six, that you take care of them, take care of yourself so that you can indeed take care of them. Know that your captain is up in the captain's chair, as always, on station and watching properly. And that we never say goodbye. We say until we meet again right here on Voice of Vashon 101.9.